Transportation Education Subcommittee to order. I'd like to thank everybody who's attending today. I think we're going to have some very moving testimony from the parents of Amanda Berglund. Bill and Karen will be our first testifiers this morning, and they're going to share some of their concerns and their insight to what we're going to be talking about, different kind of licensing and how we should be addressing these Type 3 vehicles that are transporting our students. So at this point, I would like to call the Berglunds up to the mic and just identify yourselves to the mic and state your names, and then just feel at ease. It's a long table and very formal, but we just want to hear your story.
Good morning. Today we sit before you as deeply saddened parents. On May 17th, 2007, our beautiful, beloved daughter, Amanda, did not make it home from school due to the fact of a careless and irresponsible person who should not have been driving, and because of a law that should have been in place requiring these drivers to do the same training as school bus drivers. How can anyone justify that our children being transported out of the district don't deserve the same safety precautions as those on buses? We as parents put our trust in the school district, assuming our daughter was transported with the same safety care as she has been in previous years on the bus in our district. Had we known the lack of safety requirements of these drivers, we would have never allowed our daughter to be transported by this company. These drivers are responsible for innocent children, and on top of it, most of our special needs children, which there is training to undergo and how to assist them as needed. No company should have the responsibility of transporting children without the same requirements as a bus driver.
The biggest thing that...
Excuse me. Can you guys just get over a little formality here and just introduce yourselves and present your names for the record?
Sure. My name is William Berglund, Amanda's father.
Karen Berglund, Amanda's mother.
Thank you.
The biggest thing we didn't understand is our daughter was transported within the district years previous on a bus, and because they couldn't meet her needs, she was transported out of the district. And then the minute that happened, all safety regulations went out the door. She didn't deserve the same treatment without our knowledge. We assumed the school district hired this company, that she was going to be taken care of the same way she was in previous years. Our biggest frustration is, how can anyone justify that the minute she gets bussed out of the district, she doesn't get taken care of? This wouldn't have happened had this law been in place. We really feel this could have been prevented.
Mrs. Berglund, you have expressed to me earlier that you didn't realize that these weren't school district employees.
No, we did not know that. We figured they had the same credentials as a bus driver. So otherwise, you know, you don't want to label somebody, but, you know, you can kind of assume.
One day she came home and Bill was out there meeting, getting her out of the van. He came in the house and kind of shook his head. And I said, you can't judge a book by its cover. These are people hired the school district. They're required to keep her safe. And that was it. So we're very upset with the lack of knowledge that we weren't aware, because we never would have put her in that van, ever.
Should I keep reading here?
We just feel now that if we can push to get this law changed, that nobody else will ever have to go through what we have to go through for the rest of our life.
Okay. The loss of our daughter is the most painful thing imaginable. Amanda was a sweet, loving, respectful girl. She far exceeded qualities of our average 14-year-old girl, as she by everyone who knew her. Her love for life shined everywhere she went. Her biggest goal and dream was to become an author. She was a very loving and protective big sister. We lost a piece of our family, and there is a hole in our hearts that we can never be filled. This horrible tragedy could have and should have been prevented had this law been in place. We hope and pray that this law will change so no family ever has to go through what we are going through and will have to go through for the rest of our lives. And again, we as parents, after the whole incident happened to us, to find out that this driver was under the influence of marijuana and actually was or had the marijuana in the vehicle with him, just proves the fact that, you know, something's got to be changed. There's no reason for anybody to be driving children around in this state. And if this person would have had drug testing, background checks, they don't even have to have anything of this. And as parents, that really infuriates us. And I hope that no other parent has to go through this situation, because they shouldn't have to, because this is a very tragic, horrifying deal that we have to go through because of a law that, to me, should have been...
She would still be here
today. Would still be here if this law was in effect.
Even in the bottom of my heart.
Well, I appreciate you guys coming and testifying. I know how hard this is. It's hard for us to hear this as parents, and you know, I can't express my sympathy for you. But it is very important that you've shared your story with us, because I think that this committee will be discussing how to move forward to address what this accident has exposed as kind of a loophole that. We feel, I think, talking amongst members of the committee, that we need to do something. And I will ask if there's any questions by any of Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And thank you, Mr. and Mrs. Berglund, for coming today. I know this is very difficult for you. As a parent of our family, we did lose a child as well, not in the same circumstances, but certainly understand the grief and the loss that you must feel. And know that it's tough for you to come here and talk about this, and we appreciate it very much. And I don't know if today we have anybody from the company that was, we do, from, because one thing I'd like to understand more completely is the kind of requirements that the private companies are requiring of drivers and how they differ from what we do in the public transportation world. I know that oftentimes we can write all kinds of laws and regulations, and people can still evade them and do things that they're not required to do. And I think the critical thing here is to understand if there are things that we can do that would provide greater assurance that these kinds of incidents wouldn't happen, or that there would be greater assurance that individuals would not have the leeway to do the things. Obviously, this driver was not complying with the basic vehicle law, much less any other kind of regulations.
Correct.
But so we are, as Senator Olsen has mentioned, we're very interested in trying to understand what the circumstances are and how best to do everything we can to prevent any kind of loss like this in the future. But very much are sorry, saddened by your loss, and appreciate your coming today.
As a parent, if you are to go to your children's school, you have to have a background check if you're going to go to any public function. With a kid, for instance, a field trip. As a parent, you have to have a background check. Well, to me, I don't understand how can a driver not have to have a background check. That's with your kids every single day, different students.
And they're not only transporting
children,
they're transporting children with special needs, which requires even that much more
attention,
care and attention and training and
all the above. Well, something's got to change. It has to change.
Any other questions? Okay. We will take your compelling testimony to heart, and I'm looking at drafting a bill to address these Type 3 vehicles, and we'll be working with Captain Urquhart, who will be testifying in just a minute, with the State Patrol, some of their concerns, and we've heard, you know, about the drug and alcohol testing and ways that we might be able to address that, and some kind of endorsement also. It just makes sense that these are our kids, and we need to protect them when they're being transported. And you bring up a very good point that a lot of these kids are special needs kids too, and that we should be sure that the people driving them are properly trained and also not under the influence of marijuana or carrying marijuana around in their vehicle. So once again, thank you for sharing your story with us. And we will move on to Captain Urquhart and see what we can do to fix this.
Thank you.
Morning, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Ken Urquhart. I'm a commander with the State Patrol. I also serve as the Pupil Transportation Safety Director for the Department of Public Safety. And first of all, I'd like to pass on my condolences to the Berglund family. I just so happen to live in the same school district as they do, so my children ride the very same buses that their kids ride. I'm really here today as a resource for you. One of the things I did bring you is I brought you a synopsis of some incidents that have taken place in the past 2 years, from 2005 to 2007. It's a brief description of some of the more serious incidents involving school buses to give you an idea of just how frequently some of these things do happen in the pupil transportation industry. If you have any questions about those, some of those you will recognize because there has been media coverage on them, but they're very generic. And just to recap from our previous meeting, the State Patrol is responsible to inspect every school bus in Minnesota every year. So when we look at a school bus that's being utilized today, there should be some evidence on it that it's been inspected by the State Patrol within the last 12 months. This does include what we commonly refer to as the Type 3 school buses. And just so everyone's aware, those vehicles can range anywhere from a van, a personal car, a taxi cab, the van that was actually used in this case. And we inspect about 2,400 of those vehicles statewide on the average every year. Visually, you aren't going to recognize those vehicles on the highway. And unless we're notified by school districts and or private contractors, we're not aware that these vehicles are being utilized unless they actually tell us they're being utilized, because they're not outwardly marked until we actually inspect them and put a decal on them. When it comes to the Type 3 drivers, other than basically the minimal qualifications for any driver in Minnesota, the regulations don't require them to go anywhere beyond that, which includes the background investigations, any kind of drug and alcohol testing, training. And in fact, one of our most serious concerns is the way the statute is today, is if you review Minnesota Statute 169A as in Adam, and you look at the prohibition for any school bus driver to have a detectable presence of alcohol when they're operating a school bus, this statute, through reference, actually omits the Type 3 driver. So technically, a Type 3 driver can be driving down the highway with a student in the vehicle and have alcohol in their breath, and unless they're impaired, or we can detect they're impaired, we don't have an option here to deal with them. So, and I don't think that personally is a good situation. That's something we seriously need to look at. There's a number of other things there. If you want to review another area in the law, is under State Statute 17102. It describes a driver and the requirements in what they call an activities bus. And to give you a little reference on an activities bus, a number of school districts and or private contractors will use a Type A bus, which is a smaller yellow bus, and the smallest yellow bus, I should say. And they can utilize these buses on a point-to-point basis. And what I mean by that is it's not utilized to pick up kids on a route. It could be utilized for an athletic event, to go from a school to a school or a school to another event. And that driver is not subject to the commercial driver's license regulations like a normal school bus driver would be. But they have to meet a laundry list of requirements under the statute. And I think if you review some of those requirements, this might be what you might want to consider for the Type 3 school bus driver, because there's a number of requirements there, and it includes background investigations, training, knowledge background, testing. So the only thing that's really excluded on those drivers is the actual school bus endorsement. So there are some options there that that are available to you. And at this time, if you have any questions or for me, I'd be more than happy to provide some information.
Any questions? Sure. Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And, Captain, thank you again for coming and talking with us. The information that you provided, are these Type 3 incidents, or are these the total of all transportation incidents involving school children?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, those include Type 3 and any other school bus involved. So really any school bus that was involved in an incident or crash in the last 2 years that resulted in a fatality or serious injury or some kind of high-profile situation, we wanted to give you some idea of what was going on.
And thank you, and Mr. Chairman and Captain. We've gotten our packet of material, a copy of looks like an article that was printed earlier in the month in the newspaper talking about crashes and accidents, and it seems to be from the article some lack of data available on the incidents involving Type 3 vehicles specifically. Is that, to your knowledge, are there specific data that if we recognize that there's a universe of accidents that have occurred, some involving regular buses and other classifications, but if we're trying to focus on what is involving these Type 3 type vehicles, are there any specific data that would be pertinent to that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I believe you're absolutely right. The data is not all-inclusive, and the issue there is that as a law enforcement officer investigates a crash involved in one of these Type 3 vehicles, if they don't recognize or have some kind of information that that's actually a school bus transporting a child to school, they're not going to document it in that fashion on the crash report. We do have a concern about that. We do place the decals on those vehicles when we inspect them, but if that officer doesn't recognize that and they don't inquire about it, we don't know if that driver is producing that information voluntarily or not. So, yeah, we do have a concern about, do we have accident or accurate crash data on these types of vehicles? We feel that it's not all-inclusive.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Captain, I have a question. A taxi cab is transporting a student, would they, or could we maybe, as we address this, have them required to the additional requirements that we're looking at? I do have concern. I think some school districts use taxi cabs to transport students, and yet I don't know if they have, you know, any training in dealing with student populations.
Mr. Chairman, very good question. They are transporting kids using taxi cabs, and they are part of that Type 3 fleet. I guess if you're looking at a standardization of requirements for all school bus drivers, if a district so chooses to utilize a taxi cab, I think that you have to consider those people as a school bus driver.
Thank you. And you all also have given us some pretty good information on Statute 17102. I appreciate that. We will look into that as we try and draft some language on this. I don't feel we need to reinvent the wheel. I think we can just take some existing laws and apply them to these Type 3s is kind of what I'm picking up on. Could you maybe respond to that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I think you're on the right track. If you conduct some research here in these two areas primarily, you're going to see that elements exist today that you can utilize to basically create that equal playing field so that all these drivers are subject to the appropriate safety regulations.
Thank you. I do have another question along those lines, and it would be that I don't think we need an endorsement for a Type 3 vehicle that would be the same as somebody driving a 90-passenger pusher bus. But I think we certainly need something. So would you feel like maybe a passenger endorsement used like for some of these other public transportation needs would be adequate? Or do you think we should concentrate on something that directs more towards student transportation?
Well, Mr. Chairman, if you look at the difference primarily between requiring an additional endorsement and or restriction on the driver's license, then you directly involve the department in the issuance of that license. And on the front end, if you look at the way the law is designed for that type A activities bus, the department is not involved on the front end. We do verify through our visits at school districts and private motor carriers that provide transportation, are they in compliance with those regulations? So you have an option there. Do you want us involved on the front end with the driver's license, or would you prefer the department to have the ability to review those kinds of things and ensure the industry is doing what they're supposed to be doing?
Thank you. That leads to another issue, though, because when you testified before us last time, I think you assured us that the buses are physically safe with the annual inspections. The problems are not in the physical bus, but that maybe we need to concentrate more on looking at who's driving the buses. Some thoughts on that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. The staffing we have available today, we truly dedicate to inspecting all the buses every year. And we do some when folks are available, some what we call performance-based enforcement or regulatory activity when we visit the schools, but not nearly enough in my eyes. And I really, my personal feeling is we really need to focus on this human factor. And I think if you look at those incidents, you're going to see, as you look at the contributing factors of those, it's a human that made a mistake or took a risk or did something to lead to that horrendous crash or that incident. I agree with you.
Well, that's helpful testimony coming from you, you know, working in every day in this area, that, you know, we need to figure out a way to maybe increase the staff to look at that or figure out some way to address that human factor. So with no other questions, thank you so much for coming before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members.
Next, we'll have Brad Lundell and Dave Peterson from the Minnesota Association of Pupil Transportation.
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, my name is Brad Lundell. I'm here today with the Minnesota Association for Pupil Transportation. I'm here more to talk about the fees, and we'll talk about that later. But the one thing I want to say in regard to this before I turn it over to Dave is as I was preparing to talk about the fees, I started to look at old legislation and going back to the 1994 legislation that really created greater concentration on school bus safety. And it's amazing to me, and as I recall, being party to those conversations back in 1994, how the legislature was reacting to a set of tragedies. And it's just, it really took me back. And it's just unfortunate that here, sitting 13 years later, we're now dedicating time to school bus safety again, when it should be something we dedicate time to every year and review and constantly review the things that we do. The school bus, the yellow school bus, is the safest vehicle, safest mode of transportation in the world today. We need to get kids on buses. We need to make that safe. And as Captain Urquhart said, there's three legs to the stool here: the vehicle, the driver, and the student. And we need to concentrate on each and every one of those things as we move forward. The safest vehicle, the most well-qualified driver, and to be able to provide the students with the knowledge they need to, you know, have the kinds of behaviors on board that they need to have. But it's just, again, my heart goes out to those, the parents here today. I don't know what it would be like to lose a child, but it's beyond me. Beyond my realm of comprehension. But we need to do, and the legislature needs to step forward and really take a look at this again, and then make commitments at a far more frequent basis to looking at the problems in pupil transportation and making changes. So I laud Chair Wieger for creating this subcommittee, for the chairs, Senator Hanna, Senator Rolstein, to talk about these things. But I think it's high time we get back to talking about school bus safety and really making that paramount in what we try to do.
Ms. Chairs, members of the committee, my name is David Peterson. I'm communication officer with the Minnesota Association of Pupil Transportation, MAPT. We represent school district transportation operations. Currently, Minnesota law has one requirement for driver's type 2 vehicles, that their license be checked on an annual basis. Our association has done some research into the issue of what should the requirements be for type 3 drivers. We did a survey of our group, MAPT, and also of Minnesota Association for School Bus Officials, MASBO. We got 70 responses, and we learned from that survey that many districts disqualify drivers if they have traffic citations. And we also learned that there's no districts that seem to be doing alcohol testing unless it happens to be because the driver drives both type 3 vehicle and a school bus, and therefore need the alcohol testing for the school bus driving. At a National Association of State Directors of Transportation Service meeting, there was somewhat of an open forum on the use of vans in different states, and none of the states there at that meeting had any alcohol testing requirements for van drivers. In addition, at our MAPT fall conference, we had a lot of discussion on this issue. One thing that kind of stuck out to us from that discussion was a lot of cases, teachers drive on a very irregular basis, sometimes only 3 or 4 times a year, and there's concern that we don't want to make so much regulation that the occasional driver is driven out of the equation. From our research on this topic, our association supports several areas of toughening the standards for type 3 drivers. First off, school district employees have to have a background check. However, the van drivers for private companies are not subject to the school district employee background check, so we would support expanding background check for school district employees to cover van drivers for private companies. Second off, school bus drivers are required by federal law to report their traffic citations to their employer, and we believe the Type 3 drivers should also be required to report their driving citations to their employer. We also believe there should be a level of training established for Type 3 drivers. The level of training would not be as complex as for a regular school bus driver, but could cover some areas. The Type 3 vehicle does need to be inspected on a daily basis when it's being used, so there's some training that could occur in that area. Also, drivers are prohibited from using cell phones for personal calls. There's some other requirements, such as the driver should drop the student off on the side of the street where the student does not need to cross the street, so there's some areas of training that could be incorporated. And then the drug testing issue, the federal drug testing for airlines and trucking and school bus drivers is because it's federal regulations, is somewhat complex. It covers 4 areas: pre-employment, random, reasonable suspicion, and post-accident. Being a federal program, there's quite a bit of regulation on procedures, reporting forms, certification, people involved, privacy issues, and so forth. And because of this, a full alcohol testing program for the occasional teacher driver may not be very workable, but our association would support drug and alcohol testing by law enforcement agencies in a post-accident situation. And we also believe that there should be drug testing for employees and private bus companies that work full-time driving vans. And I think that's all I wanted to mention at this time, and we're available for questions.
Thank you. Anybody have any questions on this? Senator Hamm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Mr. Peterson and Mr. Lundell, for coming today. I think as I'm looking at this, what I'm trying to get at is, are there things that are going to have a practical effect? Some of the information that Captain Urquhart just presented, I'm reading through it here, and And this is a summary of accidents in the last 3 years, most of which seem to involve regular school buses. And it may be, as he indicated, that there might be some inability to always detect when you're dealing with a Type 3 bus in an accident if it's not obvious that that's what it's being used for. But nevertheless, there are incidents in here that where you've got regular school bus drivers that are under the influence or are doing things that are would perhaps display a lack of attention or maybe lack of proper training or some human lapse. And I'm wrestling with what are the things that could be practically done that might give us greater assurance that these kinds of things would be reduced. Now you did mention that you would support expanding background checks for private companies. I don't know if they are in the practice of doing that, even though there's no law that requires it or not. That might be something we're looking at. And you also mentioned perhaps reporting citations that people have. I know I worked for a private company for a long time, and we had company vehicles, and we were required in our safety program to report to the safety committee any driving incidents that we had on our while we were driving a non-company vehicle. So private companies do this. I don't know if they do it in every case or if they do it by law, but those things might help us to screen people better or provide a basis to assure that you've got a better pool of candidates in the potential driving corps. But are there other things that could be done that would have a practical result that you can recommend to us that would give us some way to say we're making progress on assuring that we're going to have fewer of these kinds of instances?
Senator Han, members of the committee, I don't have any additional comments to bring forth on the van drivers. On school bus drivers in general, this school year, the Department of Public Safety did some random inspections on certain areas of school bus drivers. Those covered, is a driver wearing a seatbelt? Is the driver making proper stops at railroad crossing? Does the driver have a valid driver's license? I believe in those random inspections, the Tarn Park Safety was finding 1 or 2% of drivers were having problems. But when you take a pool of maybe close to 20,000 school bus endorsed drivers out there at 1-2% rate, there is a problem out there. So we would support the Department of Public Safety's efforts to do more investigation in school bus driver background and operations.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
And thank you. One other question, and you mentioned in your testimony that, and I know this happens, where you'll have a teacher or some other, usually a teacher, but maybe another employee of a district that is going to transport a smaller group of students to an event, and they may take a district vehicle, probably a van, and you mentioned that is we want to be cautious about not putting in place impediments that would prevent those kinds of things from occurring. What would you recommend that should we do anything differently than what we do today? I don't know what kinds of requirements are placed on that type of occurrence. If a teacher is going to take a group of six kids to a speech tournament down at another school district or something, and they get into a district van and they do that, do they have to have any higher level of scrutiny or licensing or any other kind of compliance? And if not, would you recommend that we consider doing that, or just expand on your comments on that circumstance? I know that that does happen, and just curious if you have any thoughts on that.
Senator Han and members of the committee, for the teacher that occasionally drives the students, they're subject to the same requirements that any driver of a Type 3 vehicle, which right now basically consists of having the license checked on an annual basis. When I made my comments of we support additional background check, more training, and reporting of traffic violations, that comment would apply also to teacher drivers of students. I would make a distinction between for drug testing program, the occasional driver, and the full-time drivers, students.
And Mr. Chairman and Mr. Peterson, are you saying that we should require the random drug tests for part-time drivers as well? Or should we make a distinction? I'm not quite clear on what you were suggesting here.
Our association does not feel quite the need of a teacher occasionally driving soon to have a drug test as for a individual who's employed full-time basis driving a van and transporting students.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Mr. Chair, if I could just add, I think that there are some school districts where they do provide, you know, the additional training for the people driving in those instances. I don't think that there's a universal, there certainly isn't a universal guideline there. One thing, though, that we've seen is the, when the 1994 of the legislation was passed, there was an actual hours of training necessary, and that's been basically watered down now towards simply competencies and meeting the competencies. There's more and more different kinds of students being transported for more and more different reasons. As we've seen the demography of this state, a lot of different special ed conditions that simply weren't prevalent 13 years ago are not prevalent at the level that they are now. I think getting more training and more in-service training to anyone who's going to be driving a vehicle, and if you need to put hours in, to put the hours in, but I think that someone's going to be responsible for driving students. I think that, and I agree with David, that, you know, random drug testing for occasional drivers would just be a nightmare. But I think that the we do need to have training for those folks, even if they're occasional drivers, to understand what it is they're actually doing and what the expectations are.
My immediate reaction to that is maybe with a teacher I don't have such a concern with the drug and alcohol testing, but when you're talking about a random or part-time driver, if it's for a contract company or something in a Type 3 vehicle, I would expect that they would fall under the same drug and alcohol requirements as testing as a full-time driver. But you have quite a point there on a teacher who's already working for the district, and they may have drug and alcohol policies for their teacher as far as that goes. But I could you clarify when you're saying that, are you talking about for like a Type 3 bus that's a random driver for a company versus a teacher?
Mr. Chair, I'll probably have to throw it to Dave, but I think that the distinction of our organization is that if it's a company providing transportation and it's a driver that's doing occasional driving but is a part of a private company, I believe it, we believe random drug testing should be in place.
Thank you for clarifying that.
Right. If it's a teacher or a school district employee, they should be governed by the school district policies in that area.
Well, thank you guys very much for presenting to us. Next, we have Sarah Greenfield from the SEIU Union, the Service Employees International Union. Please identify yourself to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senators. My name is Sarah Greenfield. I am the community organizer and student transportation specialist for the Service Employees International Union, Local 284. We unite about 8,000 school support staff in the state of Minnesota and are the largest union of public school driver, public school bus drivers in Minnesota. Our position has been and continues to be that anybody who transports students to and from school or for related activities should have a school bus endorsement. We support the strengthening of licensing requirements for Type 3 and any other vehicles to meet those standards. And the experience, I think, of the past years continues to show in of this most recent accident, and my condolences for your loss, that there are some pitfalls to continuing to expand multiple categories of licensing. There are obviously reasons of convenience and difficulty why we look and have looked in the past to different degrees of licensing, but I think that there are reasons for the standards that have been established in school bus endorsement and good reasons to seek those same standards for anybody that's transporting children. I think what we would like to see is that we're not stuck with only looking at minimum standards and at punishing or retroactive inspections after the fact of an accident, that those are not our only options for seeking to improve the quality of the workforce and to reduce accidents and especially fatalities, but that we can look at creative ways of attempting to influence the quality of the workforce. And I think the distinction has been made already today about the amount of contact and supervision that we have with vehicles compared with the amount of contact and supervision that is happening around the workforce. And I think another example of that is that there's quite a bit of transparency, therefore, around the age and quality of bus fleets, whatever the type of vehicle, in Minnesota. And you therefore see when we're looking at private companies that often bids include reference to the quality of the fleet or an offer to go above and beyond the minimum standards that are set in the state in order to win a contract. And we don't see the same sort of competition on the quality of the workforce, and partly because, largely because, we're not able to have the same sort of transparency of knowing, other than meeting the minimum standards, hopefully, what actually is going on within the workforce. And to that end, we continue to support language that has reporting requirements on the length of employment, the experience level, and the turnover rate of companies when they are seeking school bus contracts, so that we can start to better understand how we could influence the workforce as well. And we also support having more, as Captain Urquhart has testified, to have more contact with drivers of whatever vehicles are transporting students.
Thank you. It brings up a question in my mind. So you're kind of advocating that a bus endorsement is a bus endorsement, whether you're driving a Type 3 or a 90-passenger pusher, you know, biggest bus on the road. Is that what I'm hearing you say?
Chair, I'd like to clarify that a school bus endorsement, I would say, is a school bus endorsement. So that it is important that to transport children that there are specific training and supervision requirements that may need to differ from what's required to transport other passengers. But that regardless of the vehicle is not the primary reason or need for a school bus endorsement. It's the children in the vehicle that are the primary need for that endorsement.
Thank you. Members, any other questions? Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Ms. Greenfield, your organization represents the drivers of public school districts. Do you represent private company drivers at all?
We do not.
Thank you. And Mr. Chairman and Ms. Greenfield, is it your position that private companies should not be permitted to be involved in transportation of students because of the different kinds of requirements that may adhere to a public school district versus a private company? Is that generally your view?
Senator, it is definitely our opinion and our observation. I think the data supports this, that there are both cost and safety advantages to in-house fleets, publicly operated student transportation fleets, and that to the largest extent possible, where private companies are employed to do this work, that they should be subject to the same degree of transparency and in both their financial and training, hiring, safety standards as a public entity.
And Mr. Chairman, and yes. and it's your view that the private companies do not have the same level of requirements for drivers or the same transparency in terms of financial, even though they may be public companies, that a school district might have? Is that?
They are subject to the same minimum requirements as any public district. And yet we do see, and I think cited these statistics before, and the need for acquiring more of them across the state, which is the reason for our reporting requirements, that in Minneapolis, for example, that their in-house fleet has three times the experience, about a third the accident rate of private companies. And so I believe there's indications that there's something happening outside of those minimum requirements that is creating differences between public and privately operated fleets. And we have an opportunity and ought to take it to find out what that is and influence it.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Well, thank you so much for presenting.
Thank you.
Next, we'll have Chad Dunkley, who is president of the Minnesota Child Care Association. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Chad Dunkley. I'm Chief Operating Officer of New Horizon Academy, also president of the Minnesota Child Care Association. And I was asked just to come to talk about what regulations are currently in place for child care centers, and that's what I can tell you about. And I can tell you there are precautions already in place for child care centers, and maybe there's some applicability to the specific issues you're talking about. For child care centers, first of all, every staff member has to go through a background study, and that those stay current. Most of the people who drive for child care centers, it's really common, is the school-age teacher who cares for children sometimes in the morning and at night, and in the evening for a couple hours. They also have to have training in passenger restraint, safety, and first aid. But there's another couple of things about child care centers you should know as well. First of all, there was a federal law, and I don't have the exact year, where child care centers can no longer buy vans because it was determined that vans aren't as safe to transport children. And child care centers now can't purchase 15-passenger vans, so most are driving a Type A school bus, which I think Captain Urquhart mentioned earlier, and there are some requirements for that. So most children in child care centers are being transported with Type A school buses. There are still some vans because they're grandfathered in until they're no longer working. But under those requirements, it's really just a 15-passenger van with the shell removed and a school bus shell put on it. So it has the crash test protection of a school bus. But for child care centers, they drive very differently, and it would worry me a little bit about the school bus endorsement because child care centers typically only drive a couple of miles to the nearest school. They are not allowed to have the 8-light system. They're not allowed to have the stop arm. It has to be removed. And they just go from point to point, as was mentioned. And they also are typically, it's not the main part of their job. They're teachers, and they take a few kids in class to school, and they all have background studies. But the school bus endorsement could require our staff to be prepared and capable of driving a 90-passenger bus, and I think a lot of our staff would be very intimidated by that since that's not the main part of their job. But there are requirements, additional requirements, safety requirements, that we're required to do training of our staff, including the stuff I already mentioned, including, I have a statute I can provide, Mr. Chair, too. The requirements include training annually, a certification of every driver of ours on safe operation of a type of vehicle, understanding student behavior related to student, and training related to students with disabilities, training in, on encouraging orderly conduct of students and handling incidents of misconduct appropriately, knowing and understanding relevant laws and rules of the road, school bus safety policies, handling emergency situations, safe loading and unloading of students, of course, background studies. It appears there's a part that requires, I know my own company does a good deal more than what I see in the requirements. For example, we only allow 2 moving violations, and then you can no longer drive the bus. I believe that the statute requires any DUIs, any of those things, you'd be eliminated from driving. Also, our background studies exclude people for very minor things, even from working with children. So, again, I just wanted to make sure that when we're talking about this, you knew that there are many protections in place in child care centers currently. And it may be interesting to look at requiring Type 3 vehicles to meet those Type A school bus requirements without making it without affecting some of what's already currently in place for a lot of at least child care centers and other providers.
It's true. You also have to have your students, I guess you would say, need to be restrained, correct?
They do. Well, it depends on what vehicle you're driving. You have to have child passenger restraint training for any training except for those who are riding these Type A school buses if they're of school age and they only have lap belts, because like the research that we've been told is children aren't as safe if you put a booster seat or something under them after they're 5 in a school bus because of the distance of the seats in front of them. So without a shoulder harness, they wouldn't be safe. So if you don't have to have any child safety restraints based on the federal standards, you don't have to have the training. If you do, you do have to have the training. So therefore, any children you transport under 5 and any children in a vehicle that requires a child safety seat, you would have to have training on that, yes.
Thank you. Any other questions? Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Mr. Dunkley, for coming. Does your organization have any data on kinds of incidents involving your employees or employees of organizations that are part of your group, is there any data that would tell us how what the safety record of transporting kids to in the child care world is?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I don't have any information other than initially there was some federal research about the safety of transporting children in these Type A school buses and that was the safest vehicle to transport kids in. And so that is why I think the federal government is encouraging us to move towards those vehicles.
And Mr. Chairman and Mr. Dunkley, just one other, just to clarify your testimony, you said that your organization would not favor requiring a school bus endorsement for employees of child care facilities and for transporting students. And just again, what the primary reason is, what that it would result in an inability to find drivers, or just what is the major reason why your organization would not favor doing that?
Mr. Chair, Senator, the training for a school bus endorsement wouldn't be very applicable to the driving we're doing. We're driving these little vehicles. We're driving not with stop arms, not with lights. We don't pick up children at homes. So we can't do any of that. And training in a big school bus is not really appropriate training. And our staff are not really drivers. That's why we drive vehicles that drive like vans, because our staff are really teachers who do this as a very small part of their day. And the other concern is many child care centers are very small. There's only a few number of staff. If the staff member who has the Class C license or a different the school bus endorsement is sick for a day, then how do you get the children back and forth to school? You don't have a trained driver. In an organization like mine, I require at least 3 people at every center, every location, have training, appropriate training. So if there's an emergency, if someone, their child is sick and they can't come to work that day, they can jump into that situation. I think it would create a lot of challenges for at least child care centers that can be very small and don't have a fleet of drivers available to replace people. And I do think the training seems to be very effective, and we can focus the training on really what we do, not necessarily what school bus drivers do, which is very, very different.
Thank you.
Mr. Dunkley, I have a question. What do you do on field trips?
Mr. Chair, we do the same thing. You can only go point-to-point destination, but we only transport, at least my company only transports, school-age children in these same vehicles, and you drive point-to-point. So it's from the child care center to the field trip and the field trip back to the child care center. There is requirements of ratios, by the way, and other things. If you transport children under 5, you have to have 1 staff person per 4 people in some of those requirements, which I have information on. If they're school-age children, you can have up to 10, and if even then, you're still required to have either a walkie-talkie or a cell phone, something that can communicate in emergency purposes. But again, it's point-to-point. There's no stopping, no stop arms, and it would be the same type of transportation.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you for coming today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thanks. And now I would like Mike Wagner from Twin City Transportation to come to the table, and please identify yourself.
Mr. Chairman, senators, committee members, thank you for the opportunity to appear here before you. First and foremost, our condolences to the Berglund family on this unfortunate accident. Twin City Transportation is a company that provides Type 3 transportation in minivans, and we also provide school transportation through yellow school buses. So we have both types of drivers. The yellow school bus drivers are subject to all the commercial endorsements and the school bus endorsement. The Type 3 drivers are not. One of the things that Mr. Urquhart brought up is that there's 24,000 Type 3 vehicles throughout the state. These vehicles transport children not only inter-district, but also within the district. As he also indicated, these range minivans, taxi cabs, sedans. They're pretty much anything out there. You would not recognize these vehicles. One of the things to address Senator Hand's questions about, he had asked a couple questions about what our company does. Just so that you know, we go beyond the statutory requirements. All the statute requires is that you have a valid driver's license. What we require and we required before the accident what we have always required of our drivers is a 15-year criminal background check with the BCA, a 3-year background check with the Department of Motor Vehicles. We also provide training. That training includes, and I think I provided some information to the committee, that training is in line with the special transportation training. Just for your information, I'm also the executive director of the Minnesota Paratransit Providers Association. That is a special transportation organization. So what we've done is we've mirrored the training for special transportation for all Type 3 drivers. That's especially important because a lot of the people being transported through Type 3s have some sort of a disability. So that training includes passenger assistance, restraints, abuse prevention, first aid, defensive driving, those types of things. What we are here today, and we ask this committee to do, is not require all drivers to comply with the school bus endorsement, because I think, as the last speaker just indicated, Type 3 vehicles are point-to-point, just like Head Start vehicles. They are point-to-point. They don't make multiple runs. They pick up one child, usually, and head to a specific point. So we wouldn't ask that the school bus endorsement requirement apply to Type 3 drivers. What we're asking for is an equivalent of a school bus endorsement be created or be required. And that would be something on the line of any driver of a vehicle providing commercial passenger transportation, including vans, taxis, Head Start vehicles, sedans, would be required to have some sort of a passenger endorsement. What that would do is it should be tailored directly to these types of vehicles. I think there's already requirements in the law that we can work off of with respect to training of people. We support requiring all Type 3 drivers to be subject to the Federal Motor Carrier drug testing and alcohol requirements. We also support, as part of this, that drivers would also be subject to physicals. Your yellow school bus drivers right now are subject to physicals. Type 3 drivers are not. So if you are deaf, you would be prohibited from driving a yellow school bus, but yet you could still drive a Type 3 vehicle. We don't think that is appropriate. What we're asking for is the same requirements, the same physical standards, the same testing standards would be subject to all Type 3 drivers. We also support criminal background checks for all drivers. And we also would ask that this endorsement, this passenger endorsement, that it would also require the reporting of traffic violations. That's something I believe is required under a school bus endorsement. And again, annual training. And we would suggest using the special transportation requirements for training on that. An additional item that we think is important here, and it sort of dovetails with what the other speakers talked about, is that you don't know what a Type 3 vehicle is. You don't see that vehicle when you're going through traffic. So if you see somebody on a cell phone, which our company prohibits the use of a cell phone when you're transporting individuals, but when you see somebody on a cell phone, you don't know that they're actually hauling a kid to school. So what we would endorse, support, is the requirement that any Type 3 vehicle providing student transportation, when they are providing student transportation, that they say on the sides, school bus, so that people know and are aware that this is a school bus. We would also support the ability, not the requirement, but the ability for Type 3 companies to paint their vehicles school bus yellow. Right now they can't do that. We'd also support the option to put some lights, even a light on the top, that white blinking light that school buses have. We would support that. The other thing that I think needs to be looked at in this and has not yet been addressed is the requirement for type A yellow school buses to have a bumper on them no higher than 22 inches off the ground. That is something that in 1998 the federal motor carrier statutes required of semi-trailers. You will see semi-trailers with that lower bumper guard. We believe that the requirement of a 22-inch bumper guard should be mandated and would have been of value in trying to, in helping to prevent the tragic injuries that occurred in this accident. With respect to teachers, and I truly understand the school district's concerns about requiring teachers to be subject to the complexities and the of the random and the drug testing, especially if they're only doing it occasionally. And oftentimes, most school districts already have drug testing policies in place. One of the things that you could do in this statute is exempt anybody with a teaching certificate. If you have a teaching certificate, you would not be required to be subject to the random drug testing, especially because it's an occasional thing that you're doing, taking someone to a field trip or home or to an event. So that's one way we could address the Teacher Act item. But otherwise, anybody else providing transportation to students should be subject to the Federal Motor Carrier Act, is our position. And we would endorse that, and we would support a bill from this committee requiring that. And if there's any questions?
Mr. Wagner, currently, if you're transporting a student in like a minivan or something, do you need to stop at a railroad crossing?
No.
Now, if they are identified with a magnetic sign or something that identifies it as a school bus, then I would expect then that they would need to start stopping it at railroad crosses, wouldn't you think? Or
well, and we would just, we've been told that it's more dangerous right now for these vehicles to stop at a railroad crossing because you don't know what vehicle is there. It's a minivan or whatever it is. You don't know that it's a Type 3 vehicle. So all of a sudden, if this vehicle now stops at a railroad crossing, you have no idea. We would support the ability to mark our vehicles, and the markings that we'd suggest would be a school bus sign that is mandatory. The idea of a flashing light on the top, which gets your attention that, hey, this there's something unique about this vehicle, and the option to do school bus orange, yeah, we'd love that because we don't have any problems with stopping or complying with that requirement.
Interesting. Any other questions? Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Mr. Wagner, thank you for coming today. You mentioned in your testimony a number of things that you would support in terms of changing the law. And I'm just curious, is your company currently doing these things other than the ones that you're forbidden, such as painting your vehicles yellow and putting the signs on and so forth, but things with respect to requiring physicals and the drug testing and the reporting of driving violations, so forth. Does your company already incorporate those practices, even though you're not required to in your business?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, we do. We do those things. I think the saddest thing in this whole, not the saddest, but one of the ironic things in this whole tragedy is that Twin City Transportation has been a leader in its industry in pushing for these things. I think for 15 years within the industry, they've tried to get industry support for these very things. In fact, last year on the special transportation side, we were able to get some of these things done and passed in a bill in the transportation department or the transportation committee, working with the Department of Transportation. We were able to get some of these things passed, but they never made it out of, I mean, they passed in committee, but a bill was never presented to the governor, so they weren't implemented. I think there's been resistance in the industry for these standards. That resistance has not been by Twin City, and that's why we have done these things without a statutory mandate. Did they drug test before the accident? We drug tested on reasonable suspicion and post-accident. We did that for all of our drivers. We did not do pre-employment drug testing for type 3 drivers before the accident.
And Mr. Chairman, and Mr. Wagner, thank you. In the particular incident that occurred, this tragedy occurred in May, if you're doing these things, was this a case then of a driver that was not being straightforward with you? Or how did it occur that you had a driver that had a number of moving violations, apparently some drug use, and I'm not familiar entirely with what his record was, but apparently there were things in his record that could have been problematic had they been known, I'm sure. But can you talk a little bit about what was the circumstances that allowed that to happen?
Sure. I think as the press reported it, this driver had, I believe, 5 moving violations within a 10-year period. Those violations were beyond the time period of what is required, the 3-year DMV search. So we went back 3 years, and that's what is used in the industry, is the 3-year search. I believe that's the same search for I know it's the same search for type A school bus drivers. So those other tickets or whatever he had in his past, those are things that have come to light since the accident. And I think the press has used that to sort of sell print. We did that. We did the criminal background checks, the 15-year criminal background checks. I mean, that those things were done for all employees. When the Department of the Highway Patrol came out and went through our records, we produced everything to them with respect to that issue.
Mr. Chairman, just
yes.
And Mr. Wagner, just one last question on this. Was there, or does your company currently do drug testing, random drug testing for drivers of the Type 3 vehicles? And if so, was this particular driver part of that program? Or we've heard some testimony about that it can be problematical to implement a random screening, and I understand that it can be given the privacy constraints and other things that people have to abide by. But do you have a drug testing program part of your business, and was this driver a part of that program?
Well, one of the problems that exists, Mr. Chair, Senator, one of the problems that exists is if you're not mandated by a state or federal statute to do drug testing, the companies open themselves up to substantial liability by doing it. So you're sort of in a catch-22. And that's where we support the mandatory drug testing. In fact, I think it was 2-3 years ago I appeared over at the Department of Transportation and requested specifically that this industry be included in drug testing. And their question was, Mike, what do you want? Do you want state or federal drug testing? You know, and they, that's where we're at. Mandatory testing is what I think is required and provides a safe harbor. Prior to this accident, we tested our yellow school bus drivers because they have a school bus endorsement. They were subject to drug and alcohol testing, pre-employment, random, reasonable suspicion, post-accident. For the Type 3 vehicles prior to this accident, they were only subject to reasonable suspicion and post-accident. Now, everybody's on the same playing field. We do not distinguish between our drivers.
And Mr. Chairman and Mr. Ryan, just one last. So right now, since the accident, you have implemented a drug screening for all employees. So even though there is not a mandatory requirement, your company has assumed the risk of doing that, and just to try to, and as you say, it's something you have advocated for as a mandated requirement. And if that mandate were in place, it would provide you as a company with a little bit of protection from whatever, charges you might face if somebody felt you were doing this indiscriminately.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I think, yes, the answer first off is yes. We do that now for everybody. I think that it's not cover so much for the company. I mean, that's one thing, but I think that at the same time it creates the one of the issues that I don't want to get lost in this are the kids that are being transported. And the sad thing is Twin City Transportation went above and beyond what was required with the training and the things they did, and this accident still happened for us. We're not a taxi company. You know, we do more training, testing requirements than a taxi company does. And so what we're saying is, you know what, it's the kids, and it should be a level playing field. If you're being transported, if kids, whether they're going from daycare to a school or whether they are going from a home to a school in a sedan or in a taxi cab, all of those people should be on the same playing field. And I think that would help address the concerns that the Berglunds so eloquently raised here, that they were not aware that by their child moving in a vehicle, a Type 3 vehicle, their kids aren't subject to the same, the drivers aren't subject to the same standards. I mean, one other thing I think that the testing would do and the mandatory testing would do and the requirements would do, if a person is a pedophile, they can't drive a yellow school bus. But right now, under the law, it can drive a Type 3 vehicle. And so we think that's wrong. And we've tried to do what we could do to try to help elevate the industry through our efforts. But I don't think a parent, when they put their kid in a taxi cab to go to school, should put that child there in a different position as a yellow school bus.
Mr. Wagner, you had expressed that you went back 3 years. Yet that didn't bring up, obviously I think it brought up maybe two violations, but there were five in the last 10 years. What do you think would be appropriate look back in a driver's record?
Well, I think, Mr. Chairman, I think that I'll speak to what the press has reported. Okay, I'm not. And what I think the press reported is, there may have been one in 3 years, and a second one. I think you get a report, and it's a 5-year report, and they show you the most current 3 years. And so I think in that 5-year report, two came up. One post. I think that's what the press reported, and one in the 3 years. What the time period is, I don't know. I mean, I think what you need to understand in this, I think you have standards in place. I think you have standards in place. You had, in this accident, two drivers that violated company policy. Twin City Transportation has a zero drug and alcohol policy. They have always had a zero drug and alcohol policy. They do not tolerate alcohol or drug use. I mean, they do not have that. And so I don't think you need to change the standard for the driving criteria. I think what we all need to remember is we had two drivers who acted outside of company policy, and this tragic accident occurred. And so I don't think looking back anymore would have changed it.
What was the second driver?
Mr. Chairman, the yellow school bus driver, the Forest Lake driver, pled guilty up in Washington County to a charge of, I think it was something to do with, he was on an illegal route. He was not supposed to be on that route, or he made an illegal stop. So the Washington County driver pled guilty and paid a fine for his actions in this. And I believe what he did was in violation of his company's policies too. So, I mean, that's what you have, is it's individuals who have acted irresponsibly that have caused this tragedy.
Members, any other questions? Mr. Wagner, thank you for coming before us today.
Thank you for the time.
At this point, I'll open it up to the audience. If anybody else would like to testify, please come forward, state your name, and we'll hear what you have to say.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Lyle Hicks. I'm a private school bus contractor. I'm also speaking on behalf of the Minnesota School Bus Operators Association, which represents private school bus contractors across the state of Minnesota. For the record, our association does now and has always supported the endorsement of all school bus drivers. I think it's important to make a distinction with regard to types of transportation. We have regular to and from transportation that picks a student up and takes them home, or may take them between activities. We have scheduled extracurricular, where large buses are taking students to various field trips and athletic endeavors. And then we have incidental transportation, which would really be where the one student being taken home by a teacher or a principal, et cetera, would fall under that incidental transportation. We're not really sure. In fact, we feel that incidental transportation certainly wouldn't come under that to and from or regularly scheduled, and therefore those people likely wouldn't need to be in compliance. But we do feel very strongly that anybody who is transporting students to and from school, public or private school, ought to be held to the high standards that are set forth for school bus drivers of regular yellow school buses in our state. The previous speaker referred to point-to-point transportation. Type A's are used for any kind of transportation, most commonly used for special ed students. Students with special access needs, where the buses or the van needs to get up into a small driveway, or where there are only one or two students being transported at a time. But they do make more than one stop frequently on the way to and from school. They're also used because they're a lot cheaper. And this whole argument or discussion here has a great deal to do with funding. And I don't think that that's what we want to discuss today, but it really is a case that these are the lowest cost way to transport small groups of students to and from school or to school activities. So they're going to be used when they can. It doesn't mean that those students should be afforded any less high level of standard for those drivers who are transporting them. I guess one last statement I would like to make is I would like to take great exception to the statements that Ms. Greenfield made, that contract operations are perhaps not as safe as district-owned. Typically in a contract situation, that's their business. That's all they're doing. They don't have a manager who is for the transportation service who may have functions other than school transportation during the day. And they're very dedicated to the students and to the safety of those students.
Mr. Hicks?
Yes.
Do you think that school districts, that we should maybe look at going back to categorical funding for bus or transportation?
The short answer would be yes, in some form. I'm not sure that the old formulas are the way to go, but I certainly think that because of the this very separate inflationary factors that affect transportation, it really needs to be considered separately from the general education cost. Fuel, insurance, vehicles, safety mandates all put a great strain on the budgets for all the school districts because of the cost to comply with all of those things. So I think tying the inflationary factors to the regular foundation aid numbers is really not an accurate way to pay the schools or reimburse the schools for their cost of transporting students.
Members, any questions? Without hearing any more, thank you for coming before us.
Thank you for having me.
Is there anyone else who would like to testify on the safety end of this? If not, I'm going to turn the chairmanship over to Senator Hand, and we're going to talk about transportation fees.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We had some discussion at our last meeting about the issue of fees for transportation, and we had invited some superintendents and others to come and testify. I don't know if anybody is here. I did not hear that there were. And Mr. Lundell had indicated earlier in his testimony on the safety issues that he may have some comments on that, and I'm wondering if, Mr. Lundell, you'd like to talk a little bit about this and before we proceed any further, and perhaps some other testifiers who were intending to come wait might show up in the meantime.
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, Lyle Hicks kind of segued for me here because he talked about the categorical transportation funding and the need to look at going back to that. And I think my comments would really be, similar to what Mr. Hicks has just said. And Senator Hand, I really want to, couch my comments in the great respect I have for you as a member of the former member of the Eden Prairie School Board when you worked on this fee issue. And I know that you've wrestled with the fee issue for a long time, and I think that that's dealing with the transportation roll-in and how the costs and pitting transportation against classroom expenses and finding ways to make it all work out in the end, I think is very, very difficult. And I think it really comes from the fact that we rolled in transportation in the first place. And I think that those who can say why that was done is that transportation is part of the school day. When a kid gets on the bus in the morning, not until he gets off the bus at night, it's all part of the school day. Why would this set of expenditures be protected over a set of expenditures when the child's in the building? So I think that those arguments are there, but I think that, as we've heard today, there are so many complications or factors that in transportation need to be considered. And we need to get the resources to transportation, and I think that's what you're trying to do, and I think from MAPT's perspective, what we're trying to accomplish as well is, and I think that right now, all the money in the general fund seems to be the most flexible way of doing things. But it's only flexible in the fact that you can make decisions across a broad range of activities, but you still have to pick certain activities that you're not going to do, or do to a certain extent. I think what's happened is a lot of districts have gone back to, law and the walking distance on the 1 and 2 miles with the lack of the non-regular transportation, some of those other types of factors that used to be in the law to help take care of that. And I think that we really need to look at kind of creating maybe not the old transportation formula, but a transportation formula that's going to give districts the kinds of resources they need to do what they believe is in the best interest of transporting students in their district. I've said it before and I'll say it again. The yellow school bus is the safest mode of transportation. What we see with a lot of the cuts to transportation is kids getting off that bus. They're either walking, they're driving in individual cars, they're carpooling, whatever they're doing. And the accident rate that are is much higher for those vehicles, and students that are in fatalities going to and from school, it's astronomical difference between those not using the yellow school bus and those whether they're biking, walking, or in a private car. So I think that getting as many kids on the yellow school bus is what we should be working toward. The other problem with the fees, and I'll just kind of segue to the fees, when you start charging fees, and Chuck Holden's here from Anoka, and I'll just at his at risk of misquoting him, I'll just kind of use his example, is that one of the things you see when fees start to be charged, you see half full school buses driving by kids who are walking to the same destination. Because one set of parents said, we'll pay the fee, the other set of parents said, we can't or won't pay the fee. And so you get a less efficient system. If it's done mid-year, you can't disrupt the transportation routing, and so you just get it could be a whole mess. And I think that it would be nice to be able to plan at the beginning of the year and say, these are the resources we have, these are what we're going to do, and this is how we're going to do it.
The last couple of years, I believe, and I think, Senator Hahn, you were a co-author on a bill that talked about doing the levy for hazardous transportation. And I know that Senator Scheid was a chief author in the House, Representative Hartman. Part of that legislation about the school districts may have a school safe transportation safety committee did make it into law, but the funding end of that did not get into law. I think that what we may need to look at is, in conjunction with any kind of new transportation funding or funding that would be specifically for transportation, is to have districts put together the kinds of plans they think they need to have to make safe transportation available to all children who need it and want it, and then get some kind of funding system to do that. The problem gets to be, of course, is that, you know, we talk about districts doing plans. It's another plan for districts to do. It's another plan to be okayed by the Department of Education. We see the state bureaucracy. I just was looking at the revenue forecast, so my guess is there will be even less folks in the state bureaucracy, come after this session. But I just think that there are some paperwork issues. But I really do think that there has to be some middle ground here that can be found where we bring back that ability of districts to see what they need to do in terms of transportation and then to take care of that. I think the other problem with the fee issue is, where do you start making the demarcations? And if all of a sudden it's 1 to 2 miles, well, the legislature says, well, now it's going to be 3 miles or now it's going to be 5 miles. You get out to many rural districts where, especially the way that schools are built now, where you have a school that's kind of in the middle of nowhere because of a consolidated district situation where nobody lives within a mile of the school. And then how does a district in that situation employ a fee structures? And they're going to have heavy needs as well. So I think I'm very sympathetic with where you're coming from on the need to get transportation and fund transportation. We don't think that universally fees are the way to do that. There may be some application for fees in some instances. I know Eden Prairie has worked very, very hard, and because of the demography or the geography of the district, is able to do some things that other districts may not be able to do. So I think that, but I think in the end, we really have to go back to looking at transportation as a kind of distinct, like capital, a distinct set of expenditures made by school districts to accomplish a certain purpose. And those costs should not be pitted against costs elsewhere in the operation.
And Mr. Lindell, thank you for your comments. And I did want to just get you to elaborate a little bit the limits that we have in law, the 2 mile, and just to make sure that I understand it correctly, I think what our law says that if you have students that live within a 2 mile radius of a school, mm-hmm. that there is not a requirement that a district transport that student to school. And so in the course of districts dealing with their budgetary constraints and looking at the monies that they have and how they're going to best use those monies, in many cases, Eden Prairie being one, but other districts as well, have said, well, we're a fairly compact district in terms of population. We could, in effect, say we're not going to transport those students within that 2 mile limit, but we would offer that on a fee basis if parents wish to have that. And that's exactly what Eden Prairie got them down this path, and what they were looking for, and what I was trying to do is to find a way to make that fee structure be a little bit less discriminatory, I guess, if you will, by giving them some latitude in how they assess that fee. Basically, we were proposing that if they're going to charge a fee, that they could, if they wished, spread the fee among all the students in the district so that you wouldn't have that draw the line, and on one half of the line or one side of the line you pay a fee, other across the street you don't, and recognize that there's a benefit to the whole community to getting people to school safely. But the part of that that is troubling is that I know in Eden Prairie, for example, we live within about a block of an elementary school, and our kids, when they were younger, could actually walk to school the block away without even crossing a street. And prior to the change that Eden Prairie made, they would have a bus come to our driveway to pick up the student. And there are things of that nature that say, well, if we eliminate the limit requirement, then you say everybody has to be transported by bus, then you get into some situations that really don't make any sense either. So it's a long way to get at this, but what I guess I'm asking for is any thoughts on this limit, 1 mile, 2 mile, and should it be applied universally, or should we look at the circumstances, a larger geographical sized district in greater Minnesota versus suburban or metro area? Are there different things that ought to be looked at as we evaluate this transportation limit and how it may apply to fees in the future?
Mr. Chair, those are all very good questions. I think, I think we all get hungry by the time I answer them all, I guess. I think we need to look at it. There has to be district latitude in doing this. There clearly has to, and I think that also, in your instance, having a bus pick up a child that's a block away and doesn't go on a hazardous route. Again, I think the part of that Scheid-Hortman bill that became part of law was to give districts kind of a transportation planning committee where you'd bring in parents, where you'd bring in probably bring in the providers, bring in the school board members to talk about what do we expect from transportation in our system, then how do we go about funding this, are fees applicable and where are they applicable, and how are we going to do that. I think the one question with the and transportation sparsity is in the system for the more sparse districts. And that clearly has to be part of the system as well. But there's some other things that I think that are really happening. Going back to the 1994 or 1995 session when transportation was rolled in, you think of how many more charter schools there are now and how that's caused different issues, the rising number of private schools and the transportation that's required by them. Those things are taken care of through state appropriations, but in many cases, there's kind of an uneven playing field for the district versus the off-site, if you will, or the non-district education programs. And I think that we have to think about this. I'm not going to endorse what Senator Bonhoff's been talking about, but I think that to talk about a comprehensive way of doing transportation is something that where the discussion needs to lead, and then how do you get to that? I mean, I think district-owned and our district is the districts are still going to have to dictate what it is that they're going to do. I think our concern, and I think paraphrasing what Mr. Hicks said, is that right now we feel pitted against another set of expenditures, and I think that in PS Minnesota, what I've been involved with, Dr. Greg Vondell from Sauk Rapids said that when he was in Eden Valley Watkins, they never talked much about transportation costs until transportation was rolled into the general ed, and all of a sudden the teachers were saying, well, gee, are we as efficient as we can be in transportation? And they'd never mentioned it before, and I don't think they've ever mentioned it since, but those types of things, I mean, those things are happening at a district level. You were on a school board, and trying to make it all balance in the end is very difficult. And I think that we have seen, I wouldn't say a whole-scale erosion of school bus safety, but I think that there have been decisions made on the basis of the fact that dollars aren't going specifically for transportation that wouldn't have been made in the event that dollars would have been going to transportation. I'm not saying school districts are being irresponsible. I'm saying that they're in a really difficult situation and sometimes forced into less efficient ways of doing business.
Thank you. And other questions? Yes, Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Lundell, a one-word answer. Do you support categorical funding then for transportation?
Yes, I do, okay. Mr. Chair. And so does the organization.
Other questions from committee members?
If I could add a couple more words, yes. Mr. Chair, just that we don't want to go back. Also, we don't think going back to the multiple regression analysis model that was in place prior to 1995 is the way to go. There's a middle ground here, and we're anxious to find what that middle ground is. There was a lot of moving around of dollars as a result of what happened in 1995. We've got transitions and this and that and supplementals and everything else and everything under the sun, but I think we can find a middle ground here that's going to give school districts the tools they need to provide safe and efficient transportation.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Lundell. And I don't know if is Grace Schwab here from the School Board Association. I was interested if she would be here and willing to comment on if the School Board Association has any. Maybe she's not here any longer. Or
materials are here. Somebody
can. I'm sorry.
Her materials are here. Someone checked out the hall to see if she's out there.
Okay, thank you. Is there any other anyone else in the room that would like to testify on this issue? And unless apparently she's not here, and so I'm not sure if we can hear any further testimony on this issue at this time. So, do we want to continue to a discussion? And if so, would you like to reassume the chairmanship of the committee, as Senator Olsey?
Thank you, Senator Hahn. I think that our next step. I don't know if I might defer to Senator Weaker here. I think I have enough information that for I'm comfortable where I want to go with a bill, although I would like to work with Captain Urquhart and find out where I want to go. But beyond having what I want to do, I think be important as a committee maybe to work on this. At what point, what would you recommend as our next step?
Oh, Mr. Chair, I want to commend you, Senator Hahn, for just putting everything together. The testimony is clear. We need to enact legislation in 2008 to address the inequity, the disparity, the unlevel playing field. And so the foundation is on the table. We now need to put together a bill, and I believe you're prepared to do that and make a recommendation that we will hear in full committee as soon as it's ready. And we will have a couple of meetings scheduled prior to February 12, but it would be my hope that we would be able to act on a recommendation from your subcommittee to formally act as soon as possible in February 12 thereafter. And then assuming it moved ahead, we would want to get that to Senator Murphy's committee, which has been represented here, I know. You're also a member of that group. So let's proceed.
Well, thank you. I think under those circumstances, I'll work on drafting a bill with Senate staff and also bring in information from Captain Urquhart. I think it's important to he kind of gave us some pretty good clues when he laid out some bills that had statutory language that may be very much what we're looking for. So I think at this time we'll I will.
Mr. Chairman, just before we conclude, and just I wanted to draw out a couple of things that we heard today and that I think that we ought to consider in whatever legislation we propose. And I one thing that was mentioned by a couple of presenters was the difficulty that we have in identifying vehicles that are transporting students. And I think that from all sides of this, there seems to be a consensus that that would be a good thing, that whether it's the permissibility of painting a vehicle yellow or at the very least putting some kind of signage on a vehicle. And I think this would help in a number of ways. It might help draw other drivers' attention to the fact that they've got a bus or a vehicle transporting students. And secondly, if there is any kind of accident or incident to Captain Urquhart's point, it would certainly be then identifiable, and whatever data that we're gathering on accidents would be more complete if we were to do that. So I would urge that as we move forward that we address that. I'm also curious, too, about the testimony we heard about the height of the bumpers on the regular school buses, and that's something I frankly had not really thought about much before, and that may be something we would want to address, and it may not be something for our committee, but it may be something that we could, I don't know what would be public safety or maybe it's transport. I'm not sure which committee would be in the best position to do that, but I think it's coming from a company and being involved in transportation in the private sector, knowing that with over-the-road vehicles, those bumper levels are critical and they can be very dangerous if they're not matched up with bumper levels of the vehicles. So that might be something worth looking at as well. But other than that, I think that we've heard some good testimony that would suggest that there is some consensus, at least, on the need to do a little better job at setting expectations and recruiting a stronger, safer driver corps.
So I'll be working on a bill. I'll be working with you, Senator Hand, on drafting that bill. And I want to thank everybody for their testimony, but before we adjourn, Saving Grace is one of my favorite songs, and I see that she's here. So I will turn the chairmanship back to you.
Yes, I just got the message. And just, Ms. Schwab, if you could identify yourself and what I'm interested in, and you may be prepared, but we had some testimony earlier about fees and structure of transportation requirements in school districts, and I'm curious to hear from your perspective what school boards would like to see. Would they like to see categorical aid? If so, if you've got some thoughts on how that might be done. Also interested in any comments on the limits that we have in place to require transportation within 2 miles of a school, and any other comments you may have on the topic generally. So please proceed.
Mr. Chairman and members, Grace Schwab with the Minnesota School Boards Association. I apologize for my hasty exit. I'm trying to cover two committees at the same time, and I've been to the dentist, so if I slur my words, today was not a day I thought I'd have to come and share our thoughts with you. The School Board Association has had resolutions come through its delegate assembly on transportation fee issues, primarily with districts frustrated with the transportation formula, finding their costs way expand what they're given. And they have continued this year. We'll be holding our delegate assembly on the 9th and the 10th. We have districts who feel mileage needs to be looked at as a factor in how much school districts get paid for transportation. Hazardous crossings continue to be a concern. When the formula was originally put together, not the hazardous crossings like going over a freeway weren't always considered. So that 2 mile, that 1 mile limit needs to look at our modern transportation age, and I don't think it's been considered in this formula. I can tell you the level of frustration with school districts on transportation is very high because they're not being compensated for what they're having to put out, and it's uneven across the state. And I think that's the problem with it, is the support from the state really varies from district to district, and they can't make that right in their head. So I think if the bar was leveled so the aid and support from the state was on a percentage basis similar across the state. And also additional dollars soothe a lot of those pains, and I think we're very interested in driver training and driver capabilities and qualifications for drivers. The School Boards Association generally is interested in background checks and in hiring that bar for all school district employees. But our one concern comes with our coaches and our advisors to the debate teams or to the speech teams or the sixth grade basketball team, that we use school-owned vehicles that do have the school district identified on the side of the vehicle that transport kids all around to these meets. And, in fact, if we're going to have the coach on the bus with some kind of endorsed driver, the cost of that program is going to go up. And right now we don't have the ability to fund that. That's just not available. So we'll have to pass it on to the families or cut another program in order to do that. So I ask you to be very delicate as you go forward. Districts want to do the right thing, and I know you do too. And I think together we can come up with some standards that will benefit all Minnesota kids.
And thank you, Ms. Schwab. But just one other question. The school boards, the issue levy authorization, or the ability for a board to pass or implement a transportation levy, and what is the level of interest in that? And the reason I ask that is I think that the transportation needs for every district are pretty unique, and it's very difficult to try to craft at the state at a state level, I think, a policy or a structure that would be adequate to address all the differences that we find. And would there be an interest in your view from your organization to look at what if we granted greater authority for boards to raise money and address transportation on a more local level? Is that something you would comment on at this time?
Mr. Chairman and members, I believe giving school districts more authority to levy to their local voters supported with some equalization. I mean, there really are some different tax bases across the state of Minnesota. might be something my people are really interested in. They really feel pushed against the wall, and if you had the opportunity to attend the referendum hearing, it was very passionate testimony from the public that's really looking for rationales and reasons of continuing mandates that cost us more money. And I suppose in the end, when you give us ways that we can make it work out, and people understand transportation, they understand when my child has to, we live a mile away from school and my child has to walk, or they have to go over a freeway crossing, or parents get that fact. And I think that's something we're happy to talk to our communities about. I think school districts are feeling some desperation where that would probably not be our first choice. But certainly some would value the ability to go to their communities with that option.
And, Ms. Schwab, if it was a board-authorized levy versus a would that change at all?
Well, interestingly, excuse me, Mr. Chairman and members, interestingly enough, my association has a strong position that we want to go forward with a voter-approved referendum where we actually feel it's important to include the public in those discussions. It certainly would be an easier way, but school board members across the state have already found out that they have to work with their public on almost a daily basis, and bringing them into the loop is something that's being really tested right now in the association. We actually have a position coming up on the 9th and 10th that will address whether school districts should have some discretionary authority, and I can't tell you the way that vote's going to go.
And, Ms. Robb, one last question on the transportation issue. Currently, as you know, as everyone knows, we no longer have a formula, although I know from my experience in Eden Prairie that we typically were cognizant of what that amount was that we were spending on transportation. Do you have any information or knowledge about how this plays into when we're doing contract negotiations, for example? Do boards try to point out to in the course of their negotiation that even though there's not a dedicated formula, there still is a necessity to preserve a certain amount of funding for transport. Does that play into the negotiation process? Is that a factor? How is that managed? Any thoughts or information on that question?
Mr. Chairman and members, that definitely plays into it. I believe it's a 4, I'm trying to remember the exact percentage, but it's in between 4% and 5%. That was set aside originally as part of the general education formula when it was rolled in.
Right.
And it's something we remind our members all of, that's really set aside for inflation and does grow. As the general education formula does grow, that amount does grow too. And it's been an inherent discussion for years in education whether a categorical funding stream is better than giving that money with the general ed formula. And I think when you just cut to the chase, the problem is that in between 4 and 5 numbers, not covering a lot of districts' transportation needs.
And, Ms. Schwab, is it have districts been able to preserve that funding and say we want to keep this out of the contract negotiation pool of resources? Or is that the question? I guess is, does a categorical aid bring some assurances that money gets preserved that is today not happening or maybe more difficult to happen? Any?
Mr. Chairman and members, with gas prices and oil jumping all over the places, and those we set contracts out, but sooner or later, if prices of transporting kids goes higher than that 4.5%, our contracts show it, and I think they have started to show it. If you're, I can think of one school district that transports kids over 1 million miles in their school district. Certainly, their costs have exceeded that statewide number as we've gone forward. In the higher, the more miles you transport, or the more obstacles such as freeways you come into contact with, those are all things that are trigger points along the way for a transportation funding formula. And because it was rolled in a while ago, those triggers and those items haven't been readdressed. And though the general education formula has gone up, there's no link to actual costs we're having to face at schools.
Thank you. Any questions from other members of the committee? Not. Well, thank you, Ms. Schwab, for your testimony. I appreciate your helpfulness on this. And as we move forward, we'll try to take your thoughts into consideration as well. Thank you. Pardon me, are we ready to be adjourned? I guess without anybody else here in the room that wants to testify on any of these issues, and seeing no hands, we stand adjourned.
Very good.
Thanks for, I've got to say, appreciate you.